Would you turn in your Bibles with me to Nehemiah chapter 4? When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring the stones back to life from these heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they are building, if even a fox climbed up on it, he would break down their wall of stones. Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their hearts. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall." Also, our enemies said, "Before they know it, or see us, we will be right there among them and will kill them and put an end to the work." Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." Therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes." When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet stayed with me. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, "The work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us." So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time I also said to the people, "Have every man and his helpers stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve us as guards by night and workmen by day." Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. Last Lord's Day, we saw how this man, Nehemiah, assumed the responsibility for rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And it didn't matter to him how far the distance, how long he must wait, how busy his schedule was, how difficult the task, or how great the opposition. We also learned about 7 steps that we ourselves can take to rebuild broken walls in our lives. Several of you mentioned to me progress that you have made this week in rebuilding walls, and that was extremely encouraging to me. If there are other stories that you would like to share, I would be delighted to hear them. In our text today, the work on the wall progresses with the focus upon the incredible ability of Nehemiah to balance delicately the issues of faith and action. My sermon, I think, can be put in a sentence. Any God-ordained task can be accomplished if God's people are willing to work, if they meet opposition with prayer, if they refuse to be discouraged, and if they keep their powder dry. Without further ado, let's look at what the scriptures have to offer us this morning. First, any God-ordained task can be accomplished if God's people are willing to work. We didn't read chapter 3 this morning, nor last Sunday. I trust you've had a chance to sort of glance at it at least. If one is simply reading through the Bible a chapter a day, I suppose they would come to this list of names and decide it's not very edifying. But if one reads it with an eye to the diligence of people who are willing to sacrifice their time and effort for the work of the Lord, it transcends time and speaks volumes to us today. Essentially, it is a description of how this man, Nehemiah, organized and delegated the work on the walls of Jerusalem. We are informed who worked where and next to whom, and many interesting details provide fascinating local color. We're not going to take the time to go through this chapter verse by verse, but there are just a few observations I think it is worth our time to make. First, in the family of God, everyone has an assignment. Among the workers mentioned in this chapter are priests, Levites, and laymen. There are men and women. There are rulers and servants. There are adults and children. There are jewelers, perfume makers, gatekeepers, farmers, guards, and merchants. In other words, everyone has a job to do. And this serves to portray a very important principle for the church in the New Testament, and that is that the ministry of the church belongs to the congregation. There was a time when people seemed to think that pastors and hired staff were the ones who were to do the evangelizing, teaching, counseling, and healing of the hurts of the congregation. But I think most of us have come to realize today that it will never get done that way. Every single believer is gifted by God for service to the body. And if everyone is not serving, there are gaps in the wall. Now, last Sunday, and again today, there is an insert in your bulletin about children's ministries here at First Free. I'm convinced personally that there is no lack whatever in this church family of the gifts and abilities to fill these needs for our children. There isn't one job that doesn't have someone who is capable of filling that job. The problem is getting everyone to understand that Christian service is not optional for believers. Everyone has an assignment from God. Secondly, in the family of God, cooperation and coordination are necessary and crucial. The phrase next to him or next to them is a very common one in this chapter. In fact, I counted 30 times it's used in 32 verses. Every section of the wall or every gate was assigned to a different family, sometimes an extended family or group. And each person knew what his particular responsibility was and knew what was expected of him. Each section of the wall, of course, had to be tied into the section next to it. For if someone, if the wall has gaps in it, it's obviously useless. If anyone acted independently and decided to do his own thing, the results could be catastrophic. But there was such a spirit of cooperation among the workers that special note was made of one group that decided not to cooperate. It says in verse 5, the next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. As Ray Stedman puts it, God records the names of the shirkers as well as the workers. And some commentators suggest that since these nobles were part of the upper class, possibly they had established business relationships with the people who lived around Jerusalem. And they may have believed that the building of the wall was an unwise, provocative move that might hinder their own economic welfare. Even today, we have spiritual descendants of the elite of Tekoa in our churches. Some are willing to enjoy the benefits of the church, but they refuse to take any active part themselves. Others are willing to get involved, but never to really get their hands dirty. I'll never forget an incident that occurred in my previous pastorate back in Wichita. One Sunday morning, one of the ushers called in sick, and the head usher looked around. It was 10, 15 minutes before the start of the service and spotted one fellow already seated in the back. He was a well-known leader in the church and also a very high-placed business executive. And the head usher asked him if he would usher that day. And the man responded, "I'm an elder. I don't usher." Well, when the shocked usher told me about that comment, I fought back and realized, you know, this man had never shown up at a work day or ever done anything else that was, quote, beneath his dignity. Frankly, a man with such an attitude had no business being on the elder board. And as a matter of fact, within a year, he was off the elder board and was never, even to this day, reelected. In the family of God, cooperation and coordination are essential if the work of God is going to prosper. Thirdly, in the family of God, responsibility starts at home. Another phrase that is found many times in this chapter is the phrase that so-and-so worked in front of his house, or beside his house, or opposite his living quarters. Even the priests, we are told, worked on the sheep gate, which was the gate nearest the temple where they lived and worked. Nehemiah was wise enough to realize that if he had people commuting from one end of Jerusalem to the other, although it wasn't a huge city, it would lower the efficiency of the workers and would waste time. Furthermore, building the wall right outside one's own home gave an added incentive to do the job well and to cooperate with those on both sides. There's a principle here that responsibility starts at home. Some people have the mistaken notion that going on a short-term mission overseas somewhere will make them a missionary. Well, going out of the country never made anybody a missionary. Becoming a missionary starts at work and in the neighborhood and at home, learning how to share one's faith and minister to people. The scriptures say that if we don't take care of our own, we're worse than an infidel. And I don't think that means to provide all the luxuries that our family wants. I think it does mean to provide the necessities of life, but not just the physical necessities, but the emotional and spiritual necessities as well. And before leaving chapter 3, allow me to comment on one other item mentioned in verse 16, where it says that Nehemiah, son of Azbuk — this is a different Nehemiah from the one who is the main character in this book, by the way — he made repairs up to a point opposite the tombs of David, as far as the artificial pool and the house of heroes. I don't know for sure what this house of heroes was, but I assume that it was a kind of hall of fame for the Jewish exiles. I suspect it was a place established to honor great leaders of Israel's past, or perhaps even those who were martyred when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city. Bible Study Fellowship is an organization that many of you are familiar with. Their headquarters are in San Antonio, Texas, and they have some apartments there that they have built called the House of Heroes. It's where people stay when they come to volunteer time, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe even as many as 6 months, to help do the work at headquarters, and saves Bible Study Fellowship tens of thousands of dollars every year. Since these people are viewed as heroes of the faith, BSF has provided a house of heroes for them to live in. I think that's appropriate. Yes, any God-ordained task can be accomplished if God's people are willing to work, and if God's people meet opposition with prayer. We read earlier in chapter 2 of the renewed opposition of Sanballat and his cronies. Scorn and ridicule from these men started to build as the building got underway. What are these feeble Jews doing? They asked. Will they finish in a day? Can they bring these stones back to life from the heaps of rubble, burned as they are? And Tobiah really heaps the scorn on, saying, if a fox jumped on their wall, it would tumble down. It's such a poorly built wall. Through this kind of disdain, the enemy is trying to destroy the self-esteem of the Jews, weaken their resolve, and destroy their morale. And friends, I don't care how successful you are or how thick your skin, that kind of ridicule hurts. And if you tend to be a sensitive person, such language and such attitudes can almost destroy you. So what is Nehemiah's response? Prayer. A rebuttal would have led to heated words and perhaps retaliatory violence. But by resorting to prayer, Nehemiah is able to tap into the strongest resource available to man. That is an all-powerful God who cares for his children. The exact nature of Nehemiah's prayer, however, has long been a source of embarrassment to many Christians. Look at it in verses 4 and 5. Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders. I've called this a prayer for God's justice, and I believe it is a legitimate kind of prayer. But those who have been brought up on the Sermon on the Mount and been taught that the model for prayer is turning the other cheek and seeking to forgive one's enemies are often shocked to find a bona fide prayer in the Bible that pleads with God not to forgive enemies, but to punish them. But this kind of prayer is more common in the Bible than you would at first realize. There are quite a number of psalms, in fact, which are called imprecatory psalms, in which David or some other psalmist calls upon God to break the legs of his enemies or dash their children to pieces. How do we harmonize such prayers with the Spirit of Christ? Part of the answer can be found in the fact that virtually every time an imprecatory prayer or a prayer of judgment is prayed, it is God's honor and glory that are at stake, not just man's. David doesn't willy-nilly pray for the destruction of those who have insulted him. He prays for the destruction of those who have insulted the Lord. And here too, Nehemiah is not just personally insulted by these enemies. It's the work of the Lord that's being insulted. This is God's wall, not Nehemiah's personal project. And that is why one Old Testament theologian wrote, You have to be a very spiritual person to pray this kind of prayer. What he meant by that is that only a person who is righteously jealous of the honor of God dare pray like this. But there's another factor that I think is often overlooked here, and that is that Nehemiah is giving full expression to his feelings. He does not suppress his emotions or bottle up his anger inside of him. And friends, if we cannot be honest with God in our prayers, where can we be honest? Perhaps if we'd be more honest with God about our anger, we'd end up being less angry with our enemies. Furthermore, at least Nehemiah does not take vengeance into his own hands. He doesn't pray that God will help him find a way to ambush Sanballat and knock him off. Rather, he asks God to deal with Sanballat. Immediately following the prayer, which may have been public or private, we can't be sure, we read that the people returned to work until the wall reached half its height. For the people worked with all their heart, he says. I like the way the King James expresses it. The people had a mind to work. I like that. It speaks of promptness and thoroughness and efficiency and perseverance and perhaps even joy. And it reminds me of a number of servants in this church. You almost have to tell them to stop and take it easy so they don't work themselves to death. It's a tremendous blessing to see people who are thoroughly committed to the work of the Lord. Prayer has a way of renewing one's strength and putting a different perspective on one's problems. It replaces our negative emotions with positive responses. And the positive outlook inspires hope. And hope gives us renewed confidence. And the result is an upsurge in morale. Unfortunately, sometimes a renewal of faith is also accompanied by a renewal of opposition. And that's exactly what happens here. As Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem and the rest see the wall continue to go up, they get even more angry. And they plot together, it says, to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. So what is Nehemiah's response this time? Prayer. Verse 9. But we prayed to our God. This time there's no mention of a call for God's judgment on the enemies. And I would assume that this is a prayer for mercy. A much more common kind of prayer, certainly in the New Testament. A prayer for mercy is the kind that focuses on our predicament, rather than on who caused our predicament. Suppose you have been fired from your job. A prayer for mercy would be, Lord, help me find a new job, rather than, Lord, break the legs of the boss who fired me. This kind of prayer is more the normal model for the believer in his walk with the Lord. Well, so far we have seen that any God-ordained task can be accomplished if God's people will work and if God's people will meet opposition with prayer. Thirdly, we want to see it can also be accomplished if God's people refuse to succumb to discouragement. Beginning in verse 10 of chapter 4, we find that the opposition is beginning to take a toll on the workers. They begin to complain. The strength of the laborers is giving out, and there is so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. Will you notice when this occurs? It's right after the statement that the wall has reached half its height. I'd like to suggest to you that the halfway point is usually the most crucial time in any work of an extended nature. The newness has worn off, the excitement is gone, Now you just have to gut it out. Saturday before last, about 15, 20, maybe 25 men gathered over at the big house to paint the house. And there was excitement. There was coffee and donuts, and it was nice and cool. And the spray painting went fast, and I'd say about half that house got painted that day. If I don't miss my bet, the other half is going to be a lot tougher. It's that slow, painstaking trim work as the weather gets hotter and the humidity gets higher that is going to be the tough part. That'll separate the painters from the dabblers. The wall of Jerusalem is half done when some of the people lose their strength, their vision, and their confidence. Look at verse 10. The people of Judah speak, "The strength of the labor is giving out, and there is so much rubble we cannot rebuild the wall. Also our enemy said, before we know it, or see us, we will be right there among them and kill them and put an end to the work. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack us." A couple of things are happening here that are very similar to the experience of the 12 spies that went into the land under Joshua's leadership 1,000 years earlier. Do you remember this story? 10 of them looked around and they got their perspective off of the Lord. They saw the inhabitants of the land as giants and themselves as grasshoppers. These people under Nehemiah have allowed the same thing to happen. They've gotten their eyes off of the Lord. The enemy looks like monsters. The piles of rubble look like mountains. And they themselves look like hopeless weaklings to themselves. These people who had exercised so much faith just a few weeks earlier have now taken a dive in strength, vision, and confidence. Not that the situation isn't genuinely critical. It is. The mention of the men of Ashdod in verse 7 means that the Jewish community is now completely surrounded by Sanballat on the north and Tobiah on the east, and the men of Ashdod on the west, and the Arabs in the south. This seems so overwhelming that 10 times some of the people of Judah come to Nehemiah and complain that they are in danger. They have become better rabble-rousers than rubble-raisers. But Nehemiah doesn't fire them or even rebuke them. Instead, he demonstrates that he is more than a good delegator, more than a good organizer. He is a spiritual leader as he strengthens their defenses and he strengthens their hearts. Notice it beginning in verse 13. Nehemiah wisely perceives that neither exhaustion nor the piles of rubble are the real problem. Fear is the real problem. These other things are merely smoke screens for fear. So he attacks their fear in two ways. He stations more guards by families in the lowest parts of the wall, that is, the parts that were most vulnerable to the enemy. Why does he do it by families? I think probably because that would heighten their appreciation for what is at stake here. History has an interesting way of repeating itself. In 1948, when the Jewish nation was reestablishing itself, their military leaders refused to evacuate the women and the children in the fiercest part of the fighting because they knew that the men and the boys would fight harder if they knew that their families were at stake. Only after the defenses are strengthened does Nehemiah speak to everyone a message of courage. He says, "Don't be afraid of them." It would have mocked them to say, "Don't be afraid," before he strengthened their defenses. But now that he has done that,
He says, don't be afraid. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. The point is not here, remember that there is a great and awesome God. They were in no danger of forgetting that God existed. Rather, his point is, remember what this great and awesome God has done for you in the past. And note well that he is the same God today. And every one of us needs to be reminded of that ourselves today. We need to remember, and we need to remind our children of the great and awesome things that God has done in the past for us. We need to be reminded of what he has done before so that we will trust him now. Nehemiah's efforts to strengthen their defenses and their hearts certainly worked. For in verse 15, we read that when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. A brief halt in the work had paid off, and a milestone was crossed. A great crisis had been met and resolved. The fourth and final prerequisite that I see in our text today for accomplishing any God-ordained work is that God's people must keep their powder dry. It was Colonel Oliver's advice in Ballads of Ireland that went like this: put your trust in God, boys, and keep your powder dry. A similar expression appeared in a popular song just after Pearl Harbor Day: praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Both of these statements, interestingly, contain some very biblical advice, and nowhere is it made more clear than here in Nehemiah 4. In three separate statements, the truth is reiterated to us that trust in God goes hand in glove with intelligent, careful action. Look at it first in verse 9, where the enemies have come plotted together to fight against Jerusalem. Nehemiah writes, but we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. The second we just looked at in verse 14, remember the Lord and fight. The third appears in verse 20. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. Wait a minute, you say. If they prayed, why do they need to post a guard? And if the Lord is great and awesome, why do they need to fight? And if God is going to fight for them, why do they need to mobilize at the sound of the trumpet? Because through prayer, God almost always provides us the resources to solve a problem. But rarely does he solve it by himself for us. He expects his people to use their brain and their brawn, sometimes both, to resolve whatever difficulty they are in, while he works behind the scenes to provide discernment and encouragement and confidence and joy. Occasionally, God even supernaturally intervenes, but rarely. How does this work out in regard to practical problems that you and I face? Well, need a job? Pray and hit the pavement. You need friends? Pray and reach out to someone who is hurting. You broke? Trust God and trash your credit cards. Need to grow up spiritually? Pray about it and join a small group. There's always something that we can do and should do in addition to trusting in God. The great 19th century Baptist preacher in England, Charles Spurgeon, edited a newspaper that was based upon this fourth chapter of Nehemiah. That is, its name was based upon it. It was called The Sword and the Trowel. Nehemiah's workers were required to carry a sword and a shovel, one in one hand, the other in the other hand. Both are necessary instruments in the hands of a Christian soldier. Sometimes we are called upon to build. At other times, we are called upon to fight. The problem is that some of us build when we should be fighting, and even more of us seem to fight when we should be building. Several years ago, I read the account of a young woman, a new convert to Christianity, who had attended a major denominational convention. She had been highly successful in business and wanted herself now to go into full-time Christian service. Here's what she wrote. "I came to Detroit expecting to see ministers walking arm in arm, and I expected the predominant question to be, how can we further our great fellowship and how can we communicate the gospel better? What I found has almost devastated my spiritual wonder. I have seen men in secular conventions more motivated for money than these men were motivated for God. These preachers are an army of insecurity, marching to the tune of mediocrity and packing the dead weight of rifles that fire only blanks. These soldiers don't even know who the enemy is." Well, friends, if the clergy can be described that way, and unfortunately, probably reasonably accurately, is it any wonder that the Church of Jesus Christ is in trouble? But there is hope. There are a few who are willing to work, who meet opposition with prayer, who refuse to be discouraged, and who keep their powder dry. Trust and obey, for there's no other way. The combination of a powerful, faithful God and an obedient, committed servant is absolutely unbeatable. May we pay attention to God's word in this regard this morning, and may our lives change accordingly. Let's pray.